A friend spotted an ad for wanting a research scientist in Darwin working at the CSIRO's Kapalga Research Station in Kakadu National Park, and saw it there and thought, Gary, this is the job for you. And I applied for it, and as usual, they then had a recruitment freeze. So it took quite some time to go through the hoops. But I then started in late August 88. I came up here wearing two jumpers.
Because when you say came up, where were you based prior?
I left from Brisbane.
Brizzy.
Yeah, and they were having a late cold spell that year, but I certainly didn't need them when I arrived, and very quickly learned what the build-up was all about.
And what was the gig first up?
We were just starting a big fire experiment at Kapalga Research Station, which was between the West Alligator and South Alligator River and the highway in Kakadu. And I was to be up there studying nutrient cycling, gas emissions from the smoke, all sorts of things to do with the chemical effects of burning.
And this is a long time before carbon farming was ever thought about.
A long time. You know, the greenhouse effect was just starting to get currency within scientific circles. I fairly early on teamed up with David Griffith from the University of Wollongong, and he came up, and together we did some of the first measurements of gases in the smoke ever done in Australia, and we were able to use that to do the first budgets of greenhouse gas emissions from fires right across Australia.
Is it easy to explain how you measured the greenhouse gases coming out of fires?
Oh, look, it was a bit of fun. Don't try this at home. Back then, you know, the sort of health and safety issues that are in front of everyone today were a bit more rubbery back then.
A bit more laxed.
And we had these special bottles that would suck all the air out, and they'd have a tap at the end of them. And when the fire was coming towards us, we'd stand there on a stepladder as the flames were coming towards us, and just as they hit the far leg of the stepladder, you'd be right up the top, open the bottle, it sucks in the gas coming off the fire, then you leap off the stepladder and run the other way. look, not to be recommended, but that's what we did. We also went up in a light aircraft, twin engine, with measuring devices on the plane, and had something like a vacuum cleaner hose that we held out the window of the plane, flying through the rapidly rising smoke plume above the fires. And that was another way that we measured the gases coming off the fire. Again, it's not something I'd leap at doing again now.
No. An accurate way of getting this data, do you think?
Oh, they were all perfectly fine,
yeah.
Apart from the risk to human life.
I'm picturing a fire and all the kites flying around and the mice scrambling and you on a stepladder.
Yeah, yeah.
Huge.
Yeah, that was it. But over the years, we developed much better and safer ways of measuring smoke, and worked with a colleague, Mick Meyer from Melbourne, who developed a backpack sampling apparatus with it's got a vacuum hose on it with a very long pole, and you'd suck the smoke from the front of the fire, but quite safely a long way from it. And with that, we were able to do much more finer scale measures of looking at how different fuel types, whether it's grassy or leaf litter or logs burning, produce different types of smoke. But still not without its risks, but we managed them much, much better and was much, much safer way of doing it.
And so tell me how that early work that you're talking about went on to influence the methodology that is now used for savanna burning and creating carbon credits?
Well, we not only went on and documented all the gases coming off from Australian fires, I was interested in how to manage fires and the ways in which we should manage fire. And other work that we were doing, which was looking at the impacts on fauna and flora, had indicated that overall we needed to reduce the frequency of fires in the top end to benefit native fauna. And I was thinking through the logic of how you'd manage these fires to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And when you don't burn, the fuel stays there till the next year. And, you know, I thought through, okay, if you burn half as often, do you end up burning twice as much fuel half as often? And it actually doesn't make any difference. But what we found was, no, you don't, because a lot of it decays or gets eaten by termites or something. And when it goes through biological decomposition pathways rather than burning, it produces far less greenhouse gases. So burning half as often, you don't burn twice as much half as often. You're burning less than twice as much half as often. So it means you get less greenhouse gas if you can reduce your fire frequency. And one of the key ways to do that was switching from late fires through to early fires, which tend to be lower intensity, patchy, and allow you to have burnt fire breaks in the landscape that, you know, pull up and stop big late fires that might come through.
Yeah, as the early season cool burns that we see in practice across a lot of northern Australia now.
That's right.
How does that make you feel?
Oh, look, it's very rewarding to see the impact of our early work I did in the early days of my career up here. In the late 90s, early 2000s, we teamed up with people from the NLC and Bushfires Council and started working with Aboriginal people from the Arnhem Land Plateau, and who were keen on getting back on the plateau, back on their own country, and managing fires that, you know, for quite a number of decades hadn't been managed up there because there weren't many people living up there. And it was just a wonderful period of learning about traditional Aboriginal burning and, you know, being out there on country with people who knew fire ecology. You know, the knowledge had been passed down for hundreds of generations.
Yeah.
And it was great to work with these people and help develop the ideas I'd been working on as a scientist into something that can actually impact people's lives, create livelihoods, benefit the environment, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Some of these ranger groups are now making hundreds of thousands of dollars every year of this work.
Yeah, and we're talking about remote country with few other opportunities for earning a living. So it's a great source of income for improving land management and benefiting the lives of people in remote communities.
My understanding is the first major partnership in this area was West Arnhem Land and ConocoPhillips. Is that right?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you played a role in that, did you?
Yeah, we were started working with various partners up there back in the late 90s and walking through the bush, tossing around the ideas about how this might work and starting. You know, my role was particularly helping me understand the science of it and convincing Canberra bureaucrats that this was an idea that could fly.
Yep.
And, you know, the greenhouse gas methods generally have to stand up to intense international scrutiny. So there was a lot of people overseas were raising, you know, scientific questions that we then spent quite some years trying to address. There was some overseas work from Africa suggesting that early fires would produce a lot more methane, for example, than late fires.
Right, yep.
And we were able to show, well, in Australia at any rate, that doesn't happen. You know, it's dry fuel that burns both in the early and the late, and they're not producing significantly more methane.
So when did the methodology get approved and recognised by the federal government? When did that happen, roughly?
It was first approved in 2012.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was the first carbon farming methodology that was approved.
The first cab off the rank.
First cab off the rank, yeah.
What do you hope happens to carbon farming, savannah burning in the coming years?
Oh, look, I'd like to see it continue to be used. I'd like to see people measuring the effects on wildlife and demonstrating that it's all the co-benefits of improved savanna burning. The research work on how feral cats use late dry season place fires to go and wipe out native fauna. Presumably by more early dry season fires, that cat predation should be less. But as far as I know, no one's been able to actually document that as yet. There's lots of opportunities for demonstrating the benefit for biodiversity and documenting the benefit for livelihoods in remote Northern Australia. It's become quite an important new industry in Northern Australia that, largely came out of the blue.
Yeah.
It was a long time in developing, but it's a new industry supporting people in remote country to manage land.
And as you get ready to hang up the boots with the CSIRO, how are you feeling about the future of Australia's science agency?
Oh, look, it's always changing. I've got myself a role helping to mentor younger people coming through and providing advice, which is good. Keep my finger on the pulse. It'll continue to evolve. I'd like to see CSIRO's work in ecology and environmental science grow into new areas. I think funding's been very tight in this field for a while now, and I'd like to see that increase.
Yeah, CSIRO's funding's been cut many a time.
It certainly has been. But I think that the environmental problems are not going to go away. The whole country's largely in drought at the moment. And, this is a prediction of climate change that we're going to increase the extremes. So droughts and flooding rains are going to increase in magnitude. And how do we manage Australia as a country in the face of a greater likelihood of getting extreme events? These are issues that aren't going to go away, that we're going to continue to need new and improved answers to.
All the best. 31 years is a wonderful achievement. Thanks for your time in the country, Al.
Thank you very much.